For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
For decades, powerful global development organizations have loaned and granted billions of dollars to the Pacific region. One of the most recognizable names is the World Bank, which for 50 years has been funding roads and ports, has helped nations rebuild after cyclones. It's underwritten health and education systems, and has shaped how Pacific governments borrow, spend, and plan for development. Many of these projects have delivered real benefits, but there have been times when the Pacific has questioned its relationship with the bank. Like in 2011, when it helped to co-fund a seawall on the island of Tarawa in Kiribati.
The World Bank projects related to adaptation at the time were pretty token.
At the time, Anote Tong was president of Kiribati, and the seawall was part of a huge adaptation project aimed at helping his country respond to climate change.
Being quite frank that I don't think as a country, when I started off, we appreciated the magnitude and the extent of the challenge that we would be facing with climate change.
But shortly after construction, the wall began to erode. And as the wall crumbled, the walls were criticized for being poorly designed and not tailored for local conditions. In Fiji, economist Wadan Nasi came across a similar concern when working in Fiji's Bureau of Statistics and realizing the World Bank's poverty numbers didn't match what he was seeing in real life.
If your poverty line is distorted from reality, then all these other measures, like you can't have a decent minimum wage.
Hi, I'm Scott Whitey, and this is Politalk, where I take you behind the scenes of Pacific politics and how it shapes our lives. For decades, the World Bank has been one of the most influential actors in the Pacific. From the early years of post-independence nation building to climate adaptation, debt relief, and disaster recovery. The relationship between the Pacific and the World Bank has deepened, shifted, and at times been tested. Today, we're looking at how that relationship has evolved, where concerns have been raised, and what these moments tell us about power, development, and who gets to decide what progress looks like. To understand how the World Bank came to shape the Pacific, you have to go back to another moment of rebuilding. The year was 1944, and leaders from 44 nations gathered in a small town in the United States called Bretton Woods to design a new global financial system. Out of that meeting came the World Bank Group, a network of institutions created to rebuild war-torn economies and later to support development around the world.
And of these five institutions within the World Bank Group, the best known are probably the International Finance Corporation and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And that's what people normally mean when they talk about the World Bank. So it's the largest and best known development bank in the world, and its headquarters is in Washington, D.C.
Rebecca Monson is a professor of law at the Australian National University who studies how global institutions shape the Pacific.
And basically, it provides loans and grants to governments of low and middle income countries. And those loans are for the purposes of pursuing economic development.
Those loans were paid back over decades. And according to World Bank documents, the idea is to create sustainable, inclusive growth by building the systems and infrastructure needed to end extreme poverty.
So the programs the bank undertakes are enormously diverse. And then the organization itself is also very large and very diverse. And so you have different teams in different policy areas. And then it's diverse in terms of staffing as well. So people who work on Pacific projects might be based outside the region, say in Sydney or New York. And then, of course, lots of local staff as well.
25 years after the World Bank was founded in the 1970s, the Pacific was entering its own new era. Countries like Fiji and Papua New Guinea were on the brink of independence, eager to build roads, hospitals, schools, and their own future. For these new nations, the World Bank was a partner for progress, building technical expertise, global legitimacy, and most importantly, money. Loans flowed into infrastructure, agriculture, and public sector reforms. But as the bank's footprint grew, so too did its influence. And Rebecca says, its assumptions.
So in the 1970s, the World Bank agenda was still very influenced by what we would call modernization theory. So this is basically the idea that the pattern of development that emerged in Western industrialized states will also be followed elsewhere in the world.
In the Pacific, that theory collided with reality. For example, land wasn't just an economic asset. It was ancestral, and it held social and spiritual weight.
They saw customary tenure, which we know is very important across the region. It's very important to Pacific people. They saw those systems of lacking clearly defined and enforceable property rights. And according to these analyses, this lack of clearly defined and enforceable rights means that customary tenure can't provide security. And that in turn contributes to a lack of investment by landowners, and that in turn contributes to an overall lack of economic growth. So donors basically thought the solution to these challenges is to undertake land registration.
Throughout the 1980s and the 1990s, Professor Monson says the World Bank loans often came with strings attached, known as conditionalities, that required Pacific governments to reshape their economies to fit outside models. For example, a loan for a power station might contain conditions about electricity pricing.
The World Bank and other banks, it's not unique to the World Bank, often impose conditions on loans. And these conditions have various purposes, but usually they're to try and encourage or force a state, so a government, into conforming with particular ideas about development and progress. In the academic literature, there's often very little evidence for the success of these conditions in actually achieving this development. And they're widely seen as coercive. So they're often very paternalistic. They can be patronizing towards governments and people in the global south. And they arguably reduce local ownership of development programs.
In the mid-1990s, Papua New Guinea was deep in debt. They owed hundreds of millions of dollars, and the government was under intense financial pressure. To unlock loans and support, international lenders, including the World Bank, attached conditions, like changes to land and forestry laws, including moves towards registering customary land.
It funded a land mobilization program, which involved work with the National Lands Department to improve the administration of leases. And they also tried to support provincial governments to promote registration of customary land.
For many Papua New Guineans, that was a step too far, and the public pushed back.
And when news of that became public, students and academics protested, they set up barricades, they burned government vehicles on campus, people in other parts of Papua New Guinea mobilized to protest. As land registration's long been seen as a real threat to people losing their lands, and that condition was quickly dropped. The debates about forestry regulation were in many senses more complex. So what the World Bank wanted to do here in the 90s was they wanted to enhance independent monitoring of the forestry industry. They wanted to see more revenue from logging flowing to both communities and the government, and also improved conservation. And so these priorities were really hotly debated, and there were shifting alliances among politicians, conservation NGOs, the forestry industry and communities. And at one point, the Prime Minister actually told the World Bank to, quote, go to hell. And the person who had led the World Bank negotiations actually defected over to the PNG side. So it was enormously controversial.
But she says in the decades since, the bank has made some changes in how it operates in the Pacific.
By 2010, in the Pacific region, there was growing recognition that, you know, a lot of money had been invested by Australia, the World Bank and others in basically trying to build the kinds of legal systems that we see in Western industrialized countries. And what this was doing was concentrating investment in urban centers like Honiara, for example, when most of the population was living elsewhere and relying very heavily on customary systems. So at this time, you see a shift towards thinking about, learning more about, and trying to engage more with customary justice systems because they start to be understood as central to questions of access to justice and local level governance.
Professor Monson was part of a project collaboration between the Solomon Islands Ministry of Justice and the World Bank, aimed at understanding how justice actually operates at community level in the Solomon Islands, documenting the everyday role of chiefs, churches, and local leaders, and exploring how state law could better support rather than override the systems people already rely on.
It was led by Solomon Islanders, and there was a small number of academics from my university, the Australian National University, involved in that. And we visited grassroots communities across five of Solomon Islands' nine provinces. So we would have distinct meetings with men, women, youth, and community leaders. And we also interviewed individuals one-on-one. And overall, we met with, I think it was over 3,000 people.
She says, importantly, the research was led by Solomon Islanders, and the project has been held up as a best practice example because it was locally led.
So you didn't have a bunch of people being flown in from Washington or Sydney and landing on the ground without local connections. And, you know, it was very driven by the Solomon Islanders on the team. In all of the most successful projects I'm aware of, not just the World Bank, but other institutions too, that is the case. Like, locally driven development does work.
While Professor Monson has seen evidence of the World Bank taking steps towards more locally led projects in the Pacific, others were questioning what happens when global frameworks still shape the evidence itself. Like in Fiji, where economist Wadan Nasi came across the tension firsthand while working inside the country's own statistics system.
And I'm one of those unusual economists who's very quantitative, you know, because I used to teach mathematics before. But about 25 years ago, I started doing work for the Fiji Bureau of Statistics, analyzing their household survey data.
It was while crunching those household surveys, the kind of detailed spending data that tells you what families actually live on, that he realized something was not quite right. Fiji had been following the World Bank's methodology of understanding poverty, but he found that those measurements applied to Fiji don't make sense.
Poverty in Fiji, when I started working with the Bureau of Stats, we followed the World Bank methodology. And they basically said, look, if you can find the data, use the cost of basic needs analysis. The cost of basic needs basically are all the essential foods that you need in order to maintain a good nutrition, right? And non-food items are all the essential things you have to spend your money on, you know, like transport, bus transport, like rent for your home and all that. And from there, you get an idea, well, what are they spending their money on in terms of food items? And the thing about it is Fiji is not a poverty-stricken country like India or Bangladesh. So our food poverty line is quite different from theirs.
The problem, he says, was that the World Bank's way of measuring poverty, looking at what people spend rather than what they earn, just didn't work for countries like Fiji.
Everywhere in the world, they don't have good income data. They use expenditure as a welfare criterion.
He explains that in Fiji, spending and saving isn't necessarily about how rich you are. It can be based on family and cultural expectations.
I can tell you that in Fiji, right? Where you've got different groups of ethnic groups of people like Indo-Fijians and indigenous Fijians. In Vanuatu, you've got Ni-Vanuatu, you've got Chinese and all that. And well, if you are a well-off person in your household, you'll get about 10 hangers-on. And you'll tend to spend all your income. So if you go by expenditure, you know, it will seem as if, you know, hey, these indigenous Fijians are doing very well. They're spending a lot of money. The Ni-Vanuatu people are doing well. They're spending all their money. But in actual fact, right, they're worse off usually than their counterparts in other ethnic groups who spend less and save more.
And that's how he says entire communities ended up being labeled non-poor, even though they might be struggling financially. And when the data is wrong, it impacts a country's policies.
If your poverty line is distorted from reality, then all these other measures, like you can't have a decent minimum wage, right? To set a minimum wage which matches the poverty line in Bangladesh is meaningless.
In his view, the World Bank's mistake was that it sees poverty as a global equation, a single model that should fit everyone. But the model ignores the Pacific's reality.
What World Bank does, it goes to all our countries, and because they're all high-powered people, they're flying, they live in the, you know, best hotels, and they're clearly earning salaries which are 10 times more than what local people are earning. And of course, you know, they usually have a jargon which is, you know, pretty well kind of, you know, over the top as far as local people are concerned. And they force local consultants or local practitioners in the field to follow their methodology.
And that problem goes beyond the World Bank. Professor Nasi says the whole ecosystem of international lenders, the World Bank, the IMF, the Asian Development Bank, all come with their own formulas and frameworks designed somewhere else. They cover their own territories, use their own methodologies that Professor Nasi says doesn't always fit Pacific countries. And once upon a time, the World Bank sat on top of that pyramid, the voice everyone else followed. But he believes that is now changing.
In the last, you know, sort of decade or so, you know, United States has been withdrawing its funding. So they have kind of lost some of their gloss and all that.
And in all that noise between donor politics, global templates and shifting priorities, it's the Pacific that gets lost.
I don't see them improving. In fact, you know, this is a great big global machine. I mean, all that happens is that their public profiles of their priorities changes in keeping with what is happening geostrategically.
So what's the alternative? For Professor Nasi, it's not about rejecting help. It's about taking back control. He believes the Pacific already has the right institutions to lead its own analysis, like the Pacific Community or SPC.
The Pacific Community got a statistics division, which actually is very, very sound. It's got a lot of work for it. And then there's a lot of materials there as well. They're still not fully utilized by the Pacific countries. So what would be good is for the World Bank to make the money available and for the donors basically to put it into a pool, right, on which the Pacific countries can draw on so that the donors don't control it.
In Fiji, the World Bank has funded major infrastructure projects, including major bridges, and helped upgrade roads. Its money has helped Fiji through the COVID-19 pandemic and provided support after natural disasters. And it has worked to increase connectivity and trade in the country. But Professor Nasi says he wants to see more Pacific involvement when these projects are brought to life. Because this mismatch of methodologies between global models and Pacific realities isn't just something found in spreadsheets. It's become painfully clear for Kiribati, a nation being battered by rising sea levels, when it embarked on a project to try and adapt to climate change in the early 2000s.
I think the world didn't really understand. I'd be right in saying that it was an environmental issue. It was not such regarded as such a serious issue because, of course, the science was still being worked out.
At the time, Anote Tong was president of Kiribati.
Even at home, there was a lot of skepticism about what I was saying. And I was actually challenged in parliament and in the communities. No, it's not, never going to happen. And I guess this also put pressure on me to question really what I was saying. But the science to me was very clear. It's not something that I was formulating on my own.
The World Bank co-founded one of its largest projects in the region, the Kiribati Adaptation Project. Focused on protecting coastlines, improving water security, and strengthening government planning for rising seas. On South Tarawa, the seawall was meant to be a promise, a barrier between life and loss. But within months of completion, cracks began to appear, and it started to erode. In the villages across Tarawa, wells turned brackish, homes flooded at high tide, and the science, he says, was only catching up to what the people were living through.
Being quite frank that I don't think as a country, when I started off, we appreciated the magnitude and the extent of the challenge that we would be facing with climate change. The World Bank projects related to adaptation at the time were pretty token.
As the warnings grew starker, Anote Tong realized the projects on the ground, the seawalls, the sandbags, the pilot schemes, were still designed for a world that hadn't come across the scale of what was coming.
I think by the fourth assessment report, it was clear that we were facing an existential threat by the end of the century. Okay, of course, this changed over time with the successive reports of the IPCC. It became very clear that things were happening a lot faster. And I think, of course, with the sixth assessment report, they advanced that to that our islands will be uninhabitable by 2060.
And while the urgency of science accelerated, he says the funding did not.
There was a time when I began to understand that given the magnitude of the problem we are facing, and of course with the update in the science, and we are facing an existential threat, and the World Bank, whether it understood or not, but it was not ready to commit the kind of resources required in order to deal with the issue. I don't think it could do that. And so what I did was actually try to negotiate directly on a bilateral basis with some potential donors.
For Anote Tong, it became clear the seawalls were never enough.
I never truly believed they were the solution. And I've said this in public, that the only way to survive is perhaps to raise a few islands and allow the rest to go underwater, because we would never be able to mobilize the resources necessary in order to continue to maintain these islands above the rising seas.
That realization shifted the challenge from engineering to diplomacy, because every adaptation project was also a negotiation shaped by who held the power.
It is an unequal partnership. You know, we don't decide. We ask for things. We put in our submissions. But at the end of the day, it's the World Bank that decides on the criteria and the implementation. There is always a tendency for large institutions like the World Bank to put countries in a group and so prescribe a solution that would apply to all, because it is too problematic to design one that applies uniquely to each country.
The frustration came to a head one day during a conversation with a senior World Bank official.
On one occasion, I met one of the vice presidents of the World Bank in, I think it was Vanuatu. And he said, oh, yeah. And I said, yeah, we keep seeing your people coming around, but we never even seen anybody at your level come and visit us. And so he did come. And we at the time, we got one of the largest projects, the road project with the World Bank. But that was in response to a challenge that, you know, we're not so relevant to your considerations. We don't want to fool ourselves to thinking that there's so much altruism in this world. I mean, it's about your... It's become so transactional, and I think you know that, I know that.
That sense of frustration and moral reckoning has never left him.
You know, I've always put climate change as the greatest moral challenge facing humanity, because it is what... It is that. And it's about... I've been calling for sacrifice from the developed world to say we must curtail, reduce our consumption. And that's the only way we can survive, because this planet now, we're beginning to realize, has limited resources.
At times, the lack of action pushed him into darker reflections about what the world was really willing to sacrifice.
I have speculated in my wildest moments of desperation and depression I have speculated that because I often ask the question, how can ostensibly very smart people in the fossil fuel industry continue doing what they're doing, knowing that it's detrimental to the future of their children and grandchildren? The developed world has greater capacity to survive than we would. And there's no question we would be the first to go as the impacts of climate change rises. And maybe this is part of the strategy. I sometimes wonder.
When the seawalls in Kiribati cracked, so did the public's faith in promises of climate finance. For critics like Anote Tong and Warden Nasi, the World Bank had become a symbol of everything that wasn't working. Too slow, too bureaucratic, too far removed from life in the islands.
But I think in order for the World Bank to be more relevant, it's got to create its capacity in order to deal with the issues that the specific issues that each country is facing.
Politok put questions to the bank about its history in the Pacific, about its response to Anote Tong's concerns about how the Kiribati Adaptation Project was slow to react to new climate science, and about Warden Nasi's concerns over the methodology it used to determine poverty in Fiji. And we asked why the Pacific should trust the World Bank. In response, they sent us this statement.
The World Bank Group's support in the Pacific reflects and responds to the requests, needs, and priorities of Pacific countries. Our engagement is fundamentally demand-driven, aligning our resources and expertise with the country's own national development strategies and goals. Over the past 12 years, the World Bank's Pacific portfolio has grown more than sevenfold to around $3.6 billion in grants and highly concessional finance, supporting stronger health and education systems, improved disaster resilience, and critical research that helps close data gaps for more informed policymaking. Jobs sit at the heart of this work because they're the surest pathway to prosperity, offering dignity, stability, and better future for families. We remain committed to working alongside Pacific governments and communities to deliver development grounded in local context and driven by local priorities.
In the end, the story of the seawall in Kiribati and the data debates in Fiji aren't just about one project or institution. They reveal something bigger about the way aid still flows through the Pacific. For decades, the region has been cast as the recipient, the place where others come to fix, to measure, to help. But as the tide rises and the costs mount, Pacific nations are asking harder questions. It's not just about how much money is coming in, but who gets to decide what that money means. Because when the model is built on dependence, the cracks don't just appear in seawalls. They appear in trust and in the very idea of development itself. Politok is hosted by me, Scott Whitey. Our producer is Kuntamari Crofts. Our supervising producer is Jordan Fennell. And our executive producer is Faleanga Fulu, Inga Studensna. Today, a bit of music at the end of this episode of Politok. Here is a collection of some of the biggest names of New Caledonian music with Caledoni Pacific. And that was beautiful music out of New Caledonia from the Mangrove Studios with a collection of some of the biggest names in New Caledonian music with Caledonie Pacific. I'm Scott Whitehead. Thanks for joining me on Polytalk.